This is an insightview.eu podcast. In this podcast, InsightView has talked to Camilla Noerup Sorensen, who is an associate professor at the Institute for Strategy at the Royal Danish Defence College in Copenhagen. We discuss a wide range of foreign and security policy developments and challenges linked to the rise of China, such as growing security tensions and military buildup in the South China Sea and in the Taiwan Strait. Furthermore, we discuss China's complex relations with its regional neighbors such as India, Japan, Russia and Australia that are all facing difficult choices and dilemmas in their handling of a stronger and more assertive China on the one hand and an America First and more unpredictable US on the other hand. Furthermore, we touch on recent developments in relations between China and the EU and discuss the risk of the EU being squeezed and marginalized as the strategic rivalry between Beijing and Washington further intensifies.
Camilla Noerup Sorensen, in your new book, you conclude that the new era in China belongs to Xi Jinping, who intends to make China and the Communist Party strong.
Yes. I take the concept of a new era directly from Xi Jinping himself. In his speech to the 19th Party Congress in November 2017, he talked of China now entering a new era as a great power. China steps forward as a great power willing to take great power responsibilities in handling global challenges, tackling international crises. But then he says he also expects China to get status and respect as a great power, status, respect and influence. So it's there's no more talk of China as a developing country, no more talk of taking a low profile. So it's a new thing Chinese leaders' way of talking about China as an international actor. And for Xi Jinping, I think a strong China and a strong Communist Party is two sides of the same coin. China cannot be strong, get status and respect without a strong Communist Party. And a strong Communist Party has to meet the expectations, the ambitions of the Chinese population that they now finally are ending the century of humiliation and making China strong again. This whole rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, that is also another of Xi Jinping's slogans. So this new era comes after the Mao era, which was to make China independent and communist, the Deng era, which was to make China rich, and now comes the Xi era, which is to make China strong.
Interestingly, China's President Xi has done nothing to hide his ambitions, which has raised several questions abroad, not only in neighboring countries in Asia, but on all continents around the world. Let us start with the Asian region. You describe China's foreign policy in the South China Sea as a salami tactics. Can you elaborate on this? What is the main objective of Beijing in the South China Sea and East Asia?
Well, the region, Asia, and in particular East Asia, still takes a prime priority in Chinese foreign and security policy. And here we have to remember the geostrategic conditions facing Beijing. China has approximately 22,000 kilometers of land border with 14 neighboring states, and adding 14,000 kilometers of coastline with six other neighbors at sea. It's a lot of neighbors. So if Beijing does not have stable and positive relations with all these neighbors, it has a very vulnerable position and has to spend all its energy and resources to guard and defend its border. But on the other hand, if Beijing managed to establish stable and positive relations with all its neighbors, or at least most of its neighbors, and also managed to be relatively stronger economically and militarily than most of its neighbors, then its geostrategic position is really perfect for China to actually be the kingdom of the middle, the Zhongguo, as it aims to be. And I think this rationale, so these geostrategic conditions are very important to remember, because that explains why this priority of the neighborhood and of good relations with the neighbors is so strong. Because it's actually seen as a precondition in many ways for Beijing to achieve its other goals. and primarily the goal of building up a strong economy. It needs stable borders, it needs good trading partners in its near area. So this was clearly a driving ambition for Deng Xiaoping in the 1970s and 1970s when he tried to solve most of China's border disputes in the region. And I think it's the same rationale that drives Xi Jinping now and that drives the whole Belt and Road Initiative that also has a focus on the region, or at least started out, it had a focus on the region. It was a way to help to make a stable region with China in the middle. So if we get to the question about the South China Sea and the salami tactics, the point here also is that the priority of the region, of the neighborhood, is also because China's core interest, the He Xin Li Yi, the interests that are that China won't compromise on, that are seen as the very core core interest, that they are also at least the ones that are geographically located. They are also in the region. It's the Taiwan, it's the South China Sea. So these are questions about guarding Chinese sovereignty. And these are questions, again, that China's leaders are not willing to compromise on. But on the other hand, they are not interested in a military conflict in the South China Sea or in the Taiwan Strait, because that would be, you know, hugely costly and would destroy a lot of the other aims or be very counterproductive to a lot of the other aims that the Chinese leaders have. So what they're really trying to avoid causing or provoking a military conflict, provoking especially a U.S. military response. But on the other hand, they also aim to change the realities on the ground. This is actually the salami tactics, you know, try to gradually change the realities on the ground, but doing it without provoking or causing a strong response from your opponents. So I think that's what we're seeing now with the gradual build-up of the artificial islands and the way that they are gradually being militarized. But when there's too much counter action from the US or from the regional states involved, the Philippines and Vietnam, then China is kind of slowing down a bit, kind of a tactical retreat. And then when things have calmed down, then they're pushing forward again. And the main objective, I think, is that to gradually push the U.S. or the U.S. Navy in particular further away from the Chinese territory and gradually with time out of the region. So it's also in order to simply increase the strategic depth, you could say, of China.
In the context of Beijing's salami tactics in the South China Sea, what does this mean for Taiwan? Also, what does this mean for Japan and Australia?
Well, Taiwan is different. For one thing, there is a Taiwanese population of approximately 23 million people that you need to take into account. And since the 1980s, we've also had a very lively Taiwanese democracy that pushes back to whatever Beijing is doing. You could argue that Beijing has tried or is still trying a salami tactic, but the means are different. In relation to Taiwan, Beijing is trying to gradually change the realities on the ground with a win hearts and mind tactics. That is trying to win over the Taiwanese population, get them to be more positive on China and on an eventual reunification, by presenting economic benefits and certain opportunities for Taiwanese people and Taiwanese administrations to engage positively with China. But it hasn't really worked. It doesn't mean that Beijing will not continue with such a kind of a carrot approach, but I think the stick approach has become more dominant in recent years, as we've had a pro-Taiwan president in Taiwan, the Tsai Ing-wen. We had a U.S. administration, especially under Trump, that has strengthened the diplomatic and military relations with Taipei. So the realities on the ground are not really changing to China's advantage, at least seen from Beijing. So the stick approach becomes more dominant. And generally, what the result is that tension in the Taiwan Strait are rising. There is this current intensifying U.S.-China strategic rivalry, And then comes upcoming presidential or upcoming elections, both in Taiwan and in the US, and a Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, who seems to be less patient, or at least he can't risk being seen as weak, also domestically, and he indicated that he has less patience waiting for the final reunification. So all these things together, and also the signs that President Trump, he doesn't really seem to understand the One China principle and how important it is in stabilizing U.S.-China relations. So all this adding up, I think, to a growing risk of conflict in the Taiwan Strait in the coming years, as I see it. And what this means also for what this intensifying U.S.-China relationship means and the Chinese way of trying to deal with it, with the salami tactics and things, what it means for Australia and Japan, I think they are under increasing pressure and really confront a more difficult situation. And the pressure comes both from the US and China. Both Australia and Japan have strong economic interest in maintaining a stable, positive relationship with China. But on the other hand, they are close US allies, and Washington expects them to support a US policy, a more confrontational US policy towards China. And they also both have growing security concerns about the implications of a stronger China. So they agree a lot with the US on that there are concerns, and they are seeking ways to counter this. But they're not always in 100% agreement with the US on how to counter it, and trying to look for alternatives to the more really confrontational US policy. Because, again, they really have strong economic interest in actually keeping a relatively stable, good relationship with China. So I think generally we can say that the more intense that US-China great power rivalry gets to frame the regional, Asian regional developments, the more difficult it becomes for regional states such as Japan and Australia and even Taiwan to balance their relations with China and the US. And they simply come under stronger pressure to pick a side or take a choice. And you could argue that for Japan and Australia, that there's not really that much of a choice because they are these strong US allies. But in recent years, they have become more uncertain of the US. Can they really count on the US being there if they need them? Trump has indicated, you know, put question marks after several of the U.S. Alliance commitments. And China will continue being there in the middle of the region and will continue being stronger economically and militarily. So it is really a difficult situation for some of these regional states.
In the last decade, China has also gained influence in several other parts of the world, such as Africa, South America and Eastern Europe. Furthermore, President Xi launched the Belt and Road Initiative, or the so-called New Silk Road, in 2015. What is Beijing's main objective in these regions?
Well, to start with the Belt and Road Initiative launched in Kazakhstan, at least the land part, and in Indonesia, the maritime part, in 2013, actually. It had a focus on the region and was initially also a response to the Obama administration's pivot or rebalance to Asia and the growing Chinese threat or Chinese aggressiveness perception in the region. So the overall idea, you could say, was to show how China or how a stronger China could benefit the whole region, could benefit all these neighbors we talked about before. So kind of show the win-win logic that the Chinese always are referring to show the win-win logic in practice, in action, and show how China could produce a lot of these regional public goods. So the Belt and Road should help reassure and decrease the China threat and Chinese aggressiveness perceptions and concern, and then gradually put China in the lead of ensuring economic development and growth in Asia. So make sure that China with time becomes kind of a center of economic development in the region. So I think this, so Asia clearly was the focus of the Belt and Road Initiative, and maybe it still is, actually. But as you indicate, the Belt and Road Initiative has since spread to most of the world, It's a brand for most of what China is doing around the world today when it comes to investment and aid and etc. So what are the main objectives? I think the most important thing here is to remember that the domestic agenda is still the prime driver of most of or behind Chinese foreign and security policy. Chinese foreign and security policy primarily still has to serve the domestic agenda. Because the most important thing for Xi Jinping, for the Chinese leadership, is to keep the party and the Communist Party in control, is to keep power in China, and they are facing many complex and big challenges domestically. So in many ways, we're achieving the geostrategic ambitions that we talked about before, about China being a strong, great power and all these things. They are more long-term, and they are not like really pressing issues as long as the process are moving in the right direction. But tackling the domestic challenges are seen as more acute, as seen as really something they have to deal with now, simply for their ability to maintain control domestically in China. And the main task here is to restructure the Chinese economy. There's a need for a total restructuring of the Chinese economy. It has to be developed into being an innovative, high-tech economy with Chinese brands and companies in the top of these regional and global value and production chains. And here, the Belt and Road Initiative plays a crucial role in securing access to the necessary resources, strategically important technology and infrastructure, and in strengthening and spreading Chinese industrial and technological standards, designs, solutions, and internationalized Chinese brands. And in the different regions, of course, these different priorities or aspects of the Belt and Road plays out differently.
In China, I have met several local people and foreigners who describe the Belt and Road initiative as extremely expensive and with few long-term benefits to China, except gaining influence. Today, the initiative also has an Arctic leg, which interferes with Danish interests when it comes to Greenland. Is China using salami tactics in this region as well?
Well, again, if we argue that the salami tactics is a Chinese way of gradually changing the realities on the ground to China's advantage without risking a tough response from the other states involved, I guess you could also argue that they are using a version of the salami tactics in the Arctic. But again, here, as in relation to Taiwan, the means are different than in the South China Sea. In the Arctic, in order to get a presence in the region and promote Chinese interests and activities in the region, China has especially used the so-called science diplomacy. That is to point to their more legitimate interests in building up a research capacity, especially on climate change in the Arctic, as a way to get a foot into the region, establishing research stations, research networks, good relations and cooperation on research, on Arctic research with the Arctic states and stakeholders. So this way, especially through research, China has in recent years gradually built up its presence in the Arctic. It has since 2004 had a research station in Svalbard. It very recently opened a research facility in Iceland, and it's trying to promote a Chinese research station in Greenland. So on top of that, it's trying to strengthen research cooperation on many different levels with Arctic universities, with universities in the Arctic, with different corporations or companies. So trying to kind of bind itself into the Arctic on multiple levels. And in recent years, as the Belt and Road Initiative has also broadened to the Arctic, or as the Arctic Sea Routes has also been included in the Belt and Road Initiative, then this Chinese science diplomacy has been combined or supplemented with what we could call a Polar Silk Road diplomacy, where the Chinese diplomats and companies and banks are even more proactive in proposing projects, investments, or cooperation with Arctic stakeholders within this framework of a Polar Silk Road. So this way, it's also a way of trying to make sure that China gets bind itself in to the region, because the overall point is that China is very keen keenly aware that it's the only the only great power that doesn't have an Arctic territory. So it needs the Arctic states to see a benefit in actually having China in the region. And here it's always a balance because they have to be very careful not to provoke mistrust and resistance among the Arctic states. But on the other hand, they also have stronger interests. So they need to also show some kind of assertiveness in presenting their claims to being a legitimate Arctic state or a near-Arctic state, as they often present themselves as. So it's a difficult balance, but clearly the focus behind what we've seen in recent years with China's enhanced diplomatic and economic activities in the Arctic, the clear focus is to establish strong and comprehensive relationship with Arctic states and stakeholders, and then gradually increase China's involvement in Arctic governance institutions and rule settings. Because then, if they succeed in binding China into the region on all these levels and propose all these win-win agreements on research, on resource extraction, on infrastructure investments, well, then they are in a better position to avoid unforeseen developments or avoid the other, especially Russian or US efforts to try to marginalize them or push them out of the region. So I think that's what we've seen in recent years. And in some ways, the Chinese are focusing especially on the smaller Arctic states, such as Denmark, because they could see them using them as a kind of a counterbalance if the Arctic great powers, the US and Russia, wants to push China out of the Arctic. It's of course getting increasingly difficult these years if we're following developments in what we could call Arctic geopolitics. Then it's getting increasingly difficult for China. Their room of maneuver is simply decreasing just these months, these weeks even, as the US has just released a new Arctic strategy from the US Department of Defense, and there's a lot of China in it. And it doesn't leave much room for such activities, science diplomacy or other Chinese activities in the region, simply warning of this creeping Chinese efforts to bind itself into the region. So it's getting more difficult, getting more difficult for China, I think, in the Arctic to make this room for itself.
Has the West been naive when it comes to China? In Europe, several commentators of foreign policy argue that Beijing aims to undermine and divide the European Union. They refer to the so-called 16+1 cooperation between 16 Central and East European countries and China. What do you believe is Beijing's main objective in Europe?
Well, as I hinted at before, I think the domestic agenda still is the prime driver behind China's foreign and security policy. And the main task domestically is to restructure the Chinese economy into being this innovative high-tech economy with Chinese brands and companies in the top of these regional and global value and production chains. So if we start from there, then it's clear that Europe plays a central role. It's the big market. They have high-tech, innovative companies and sectors. This really makes Europe to be a key in the Belt and Road Initiative. It's where most of the Belt and Road Initiative project ends, or at least go from Europe to China back and forth. So it's central for Beijing to establish quicker links or make sure that there are a quick transportation or links for people, for service, for products, communication, you name it, between China and or the broader Asia and European markets. And in order to achieve this, it's necessary for China to ensure stable or good relations with the most important European states and stakeholders. And I would here argue that China also has a strong interest in a strong EU. We often hear the argument these days and months that China is trying to undermine the EU. I think actually China still has a very strong interest in a strong EU as an important counterbalance and potentially an ally to a dominant US that moves towards protectionism and unilatericalism and that is more and more critical of China. But the Chinese leaders, as others have in recent years, come to doubt the EU's ability and willingness to act as a unified international actor and to play a role on the international scene. that's Brexit, and more generally a lot of the internal challenges that takes off most of Brussels' focus and energy. So for this reason, Beijing has a strategy for Europe with a stronger focus on developing strong and comprehensive relationships with all the important countries, institutions and groups. So again, as in the Arctic, we're seeing this, making sure you have good relations on multiple levels. And I think that's also the context where we should see China's cooperation since 2012 with the 16 Central and Eastern European countries, which where 11 of them are EU member states. That is the 16 plus one mechanism that you hinted at. It's simply a way in which China seeks to guard against all conceivable outcomes in relation to the future of the EU and in relation to secure and promote the interest that China has in Europe, no matter what happens. So again, here as in the Arctic, the Chinese leadership is trying to tie China into Europe, into a Europe that Beijing, like the rest of the world, is not really sure of where, or into an EU that Beijing, like the rest of the world, is not really sure of where it's developing. But again, I stress that I think Beijing continues to see a strong, stable EU as in China's interest. We saw it also in the very recent meeting where Xi Jinping had a visit to Brussels. There was a joint statement where there was a lot of efforts from China to try to meet some of the European concerns or criticism and give some concessions as well.
In the global environment where the current number two challenges the current number one, how can the European Union avoid being squeezed by China and the United States in the future? What should the EU do to prevent such an outcome?
Well, it's difficult. And I see a big risk of Europe becoming an arena for US-China great power rivalry, rather than the EU or the bigger European states having an independent role, or at least their room of maneuver risk becoming very, very small. So what can they do in order to avoid this? I think the EU needs an independent, and with independent I mean not following the US or not following the China, but simply need to have an independent assessment or independent strategy of what are the European interests in this changing global order or world order. The European interests are not identical with the American ones, I would argue. So this independent assessment of the strategic risks and opportunities for Europe in the coming decades as relations between China and the US continues to become more tense, I think is the way forward. But it's not easy due to all the reasons we just talked about, a very more divided Europe and a lot of internal challenges. But I think the core is that it's not in the EU or Europe's interest to contribute to the promotion of great power rivalry or to support the US-China threat campaign or to seek to isolate a weakened China. The EU has to find its own way of dealing with both an assertive US, because it is a more assertive US with the America First policy. It's also a more assertive China, and both the US and China are in different ways or in different areas. Both are challenging the rule-based, institutional-based international order that the EU or that the European states have strong interest in preserving. So it needs reform, the international order, we all agree on that, but there's still a way to preserve some of it or to reform it without, you know, totally destroying it, as we could fear will happen if the great power rivalry just continues to intensify. And I think the EU has a role to play here, and I guess the EU has to be more assertive itself. But it's not easy. I think we see a few encouraging signs in recent months. As I mentioned before, we had the EU-China summit in the spring. And for the first time before this summit, the EU managed to come with a more realistic strategy paper on China, where they for the first time named China as a strategic competitor. They generally presented a more comprehensive assessment of the implications, both the risk and the opportunities of a stronger China. It was very balanced, very nuanced. It stated, for example, that China at the same time in different policy areas is a partner we can cooperate with, it's a partner we can negotiate with, we need to find a balance of interest, of course, but we can still negotiate. And then it's also an economic competitor, But it's also a systemic rival when it comes to alternative models of governance and that. But it really tried to divide it in different policy areas and different disputes that the EU has with China. And I think that's the way, because the core is that the EU still sees that there's room for engagement with China. But of course, it should be from a stronger, more determined and unified European position. And we should try to, and as we saw in the spring with the meeting with when Xi Jinping was in Brussels, we should try to present kind of demands, red lines. What are our core interests? China talks about core interests. What are actually the European or the EU's core interests when it comes to China? So I think that's the way. It won't be easy, but I think we're seeing at least that the different bigger European countries are trying to coordinate and cooperate more on their China policy. When Xi Jinping traveled on to France, the French President Macron, he also invited the German Chancellor Merkel and Juncker from Brussels to participate in the meeting, so they try to present a kind of a stronger EU position also, so we can avoid the Chinese playing the different European countries out against each other. We also see in recent months that there are growing European efforts to try to set up an investment screening mechanism, trying to invest more from a joint European in innovation and high technology, and simply trying to be a better competitor also for a lot of what the Chinese are focusing on. So I think these are encouraging signs, and I think the core is simply still continue to engage China, but from a stronger position is the way to go, and that's different from what the U.S. Is currently doing, because there's not much engagement in what the U.S. is doing. And I'm just saying that I don't think it's in the European interest to just follow the U.S. policy in this regard.
The rise of China and Donald Trump taking office in the White House have in many ways created the conditions for the perfect storm, as this has led to several unfilled security vacuums around the world. It seems that Donald Trump alienates friends as well as foes. Ironically, this appears to have reignited a new friendship between China and Russia. How do you see this strategic alliance evolve in the coming years? Are Russia and China natural partners?
Well, we could do a whole podcast, if not several, on the evolving strategic cooperation between China and Russia. But there is generally higher coordination and cooperation between China and Russia on a range of economic and security issues. The Chinese leader Xi Jinping has just been in Moscow for a state visit, also handling over two pandas actually to the Moscow Zoo. But during the visit, the two state leaders lifted the China-Russia relationship to a higher level, talking of a Sino-Russian comprehensive strategic partnership and strategic interaction in a new era. So also here again, the Xi Jinping new era came in. And Xi Jinping also called Putin his best friend, and they signed several deals on economic cooperation, especially within energy development and infrastructure. And on the economic front, a lot is happening. Here you might talk of natural partners in some ways. Russia has a lot of energy and resources that China needs, and China has the investment and some of the technology that Russia needs to develop and extract the energy and resources and construct the necessary infrastructure to transport it. And China, of course, also stands ready in the receiver end. So in that kind of in the more economic front, you might talk about natural partners. And of course, especially after the Western sanctions, after Crimea and Ukraine, then Russia is more forced to look east, or as pivot to the east, as the Russians sometimes say. They're more forced to do it because they simply have nowhere else to look for investments and the necessary technology to develop their energy and resource base. But then when we come to the more political front or the political security, then there are less natural partners. But we still see more coordination. It's not just talk. There is more. There's a lot of talk, of course. But there also is more coordination and cooperation between China and Russia, and they align their positions to a higher degree. they might not always come out in full support of each other, but they kind of have this, it seems like they have this agreement now about not coming out in opposition to each other. If it is on the South China Sea or on Crimea or something like that, they don't necessarily support each other, but they don't come out opposing what the other is doing in the same way. And of course, we're seeing them align sometimes in the UN Security Council and other things where they seem to be coordinating much more. And generally, they seem to share a lot of concerns and criticism of the current US foreign and security policy. So in some ways, that's also what's pushing them together. But again, why are they not natural partners? I think there's also still a lot of mistrust, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of especially from the Russian side, because of course it's the Chinese that are on the way up, and of course the Russians are not always very happy about that when it comes to their near neighborhood, Central Asia and the Arctic, as we talked about before. But also because they simply do not share, we could call it strategic culture, maybe. They do not share the way of, they agree on being critical about what the US is currently doing in a lot of different places around the world, but they do not necessarily agree on how to react to it. The Chinese are trying to react in the way we talked about before, like the very gradual, not really trying to avoid provoking a military conflict. Whereas the Russians are more jumping into it and using military instrument in a much more more often and in a much more willingly way than the Chinese are. So I think they're simply not united in their way of strategic response or strategic culture, whatever we should call it. So there are limits, I think, to how far it can develop. I don't see a China-Russia alliance, but there's a lot of debate about that, and I think, of course, we really have to pay a lot of attention and closely following what's happening, because a lot of is happening in relations between China and Russia. But there are also limits that kind of pushes the other way.
Where is India positioned in this new global environment? The question is not least interesting after New Delhi is no longer able to stay below the radar of President Trump.
Yeah, India is also a very interesting case that we could talk about for long. But I think India, in contrast to Russia, India is still most focusing on its near regional neighborhood, being very concerned, of course, about the implications of a stronger China and specifically the way that the Belt and Road Initiative plays into politics and security in South Asia. One of the signature projects of the Belt and Road Initiative is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So, of course, the Indians are very concerned about that. They're also concerned about Chinese investments in ports in Sri Lanka and investments in infrastructure in Bangladesh and Nepal. So there's a lot of concerns, but it mostly relates to things that are happening in India's near neighborhood. So how best to counter that? I think New Delhi is not keen on seriously entering the great power rivalry. I know, as you hinted at, that Donald Trump, the Trump administration, with the new Asia strategy titled Free and Open Indo-Pacific, is trying to drag India more into it and broaden, you could say, the region and having India on their side. But I don't see New Delhi being very keen on really entering this. Rather, New Delhi is seeking to build stronger security and military ties with other regional states that has some of the same concerns about things that are happening in Asia and more narrowly in Asia.
Like Japan,
like Australia and several of the Southeast Asian states. We are seeing there that they are strengthening their political and military or political and security relations and their military cooperation. So it's a way for them to, on a more regional scale, try to handle the implications of a stronger China, or still seeing a room for influencing China and the Chinese behavior in the region, engaging it even. Because what we have here is that that if a military conflict starts to, if a military conflict breaks out between the US and China, it will likely happen in Asia, because that's where we have all the hotspots, you could say. South China Sea, we talked about, the Taiwan Strait, the East China Sea, Korean Peninsula maybe, but that would really, it would really hurt these regional states, and they have no interests in seeing any kind of military, even a low-scale military conflict developing. They're very concerned about that, and of course more concerned, you could say, than the US, which could, to a higher degree, simply pull back from the region. And again, they are also more uncertain about the US commitment to their alliances, to their partnerships in the region. So therefore, all these states in the region, they really stand in a very difficult situation, but then they try to find common joint Asian responses and trying to strengthen in the process, trying to strengthen the regional institutions that are still there or build new ones, as we see now with India, Japan and Australia. And that in some ways puts the US a little outside, because again they are uncertain and the US doesn't seem very eager on engaging in regional institutions. So also here we see not a marginalization of the US, but also that it's kind of happening on different levels.
I would like to end this interview with three final questions. Is the White House right when it says that it needs to draw a line in the sand when it comes to China?
Well, there's a lot to criticize. When we look at developments in Chinese domestic politics, Chinese trade policies, and Chinese foreign and security policies in recent years, no doubt. And as I argued above, the more realistic turn, or as I argued earlier, the more realistic turn in the EU's China approach, where they're trying to state the core interest, being more determined, being more trying to set up some red lines, and yeah, I think that's necessary. So that is also drawing a line in the sand of things. But I think the problem with the Trump administration's approach to China is the one-dimensional China threat, or China as an adversary that we need to keep weak, we need to isolate, we need to sanction. And also the assessment that seems to be guiding the Trump administration that there is no longer any window to engage with the Chinese leaders. Engagement is over. And I think and also that the US, that the Trump administration's approach is very unilateral. It doesn't go through the international institutions like the WTO. It doesn't use international rules or norms, but rather in the process of confronting China, it also weakens all these international rules and all the things that give us predictability and stability and, you know, some kind of leveling out the power differences between states, give some certainty in the international system. So I think that's kind of the very problematic thing about not necessarily all the content. Of course, the one-dimensional of China as a rival is, but some of what the Trump administration is criticizing China for, I think there is a general agreement also with the EU on some, especially on the trade policies and human rights and things like that. But it's more the approach that's very confrontational, unilateral, and also the very unpredictable and somehow unprincipled nature of the Trump administration's policy or decision making is not very helpful. Because as I see it, there is no alternative to engagement with China. The US cannot push or sanction or isolate or contain China to get China to do as the US would like to see. And also I often sit with the question, what is it really that the Trump administration wants China to do? Is it to keep China weak or inferior to the US economically and militarily? For what and why? And is that fair? or is that really an aim that we should support? Because that, you know, it also benefits a lot of people that China has developed economically, and there's also some kind of, yeah, I'm just questioning what is actually the aim, what would satisfy the Trump administration. Some of the things we see now with the trade war, would it satisfy, only satisfy the Trump administration if the Communist Party give up control of China, or if they totally change their economic model, they give up having state-owned companies? So some of the demands and the way that's handled is simply, unrealistic, unfair, even as we see it. But again, I stress that there is a lot of legitimate criticism and demands that the EU and also the US on some parts are presenting China with. But right now, as I see it, there is both an acceleration of the threat that China presents or how comprehensively China is challenging the international system, and also an acceleration of what the US can actually do to influence or to dictate China's behavior. So my point, I guess, is that the US cannot prevent a stronger China, but it can influence the way that it still has room to influence the way that a stronger China engages with the world. And I think the way that we're seeing the US-China policy now, right now, only treating China as the enemy, is counterproductive. It becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, and it only gets weakens the rule-based order that the US actually played a main part in building up, and that China also still has strong interests in keeping, because it actually serves a lot of the Chinese interests. So a long answer, but I think, yeah, there is a need to draw a line in the sand, but I'm a bit critical, as you can hear, about the way that the Trump administration is doing it.
On June 20, President Xi Jinping surprised by making a state visit to North Korea, which was the first by a Chinese leader in 14 years. Shortly after, on June 24th, Donald Trump had an upbeat telephone conversation with Xi Jinping. Shortly after, the US president indicated suddenly that the trade negotiations were again on track. On June 29, President Trump reversed course on Huawei by rolling back sanctions imposed on the company. On June 30, President Trump met North Korea's Kim Jong-un at the border of South and North Korea. What was the purpose benefit of this arrangement seen from the perspective of the White House?
Yeah, there's been a lot of hectic and complex diplomacy going on in recent weeks, and a complex mix, maybe even trade-offs between the different issues, the different disputes and conflicts. But the main objective, I think, for Donald Trump with his recent visit to the DMZ and the demilitarized zone in the border area, and the meeting with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, was to restart negotiations on North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Because after the summit in Hanoi in February this year, the summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, the understanding was that the working delegations from each side were to take over and try to find some agreements on some of the outstanding issues that caused the Hanoi summit to end before time and not really coming out with a joint statement. But since then, the North Korean side has not been eager to meet. They haven't really, been meeting when the U.S. Special Representative for North Korea, Stephen Biegun, he simply had difficulties getting meetings scheduled. And when they were meeting, the North Korean negotiators had not had a very strong mandate to actually go into substantial negotiations on anything. So it's not really been moving since Hanoi. And then also in recent months, North Korea has started to launch missiles, short range, so not the really provocative long range, but the short range, but at least beginning to be active again on that front. And they've also been using a harder rhetoric to describe the U.S., especially State Secretary Pompeo, which they apparently do not like at all. So all in all, we've seen indications of the return to a more confrontational line from Pyongyang. And that makes it more difficult for Donald Trump to convince people in the U.S. that he actually made a big breakthrough on North Korea. So Trump simply needs to put negotiations back on track to again get Kim Jong-un to commit to this process that he and that Trump and Kim Jong-un have started. Because that's their process. That's the way Donald Trump presents it, and maybe also Kim Jong-un domestically. So now he needs his commitment so they can continue at least, you know, saying that they have a process that's going on.
For election purposes.
For election purposes, I think, and also in order to primarily for election purposes, but also because I think he actually still hopes that that's, or still thinks that's the way to go, and that can bring some results on the Korean Peninsula. And as you indicated, it is interesting that Xi Jinping has just met with Kim Jong-un a few days before under his state visit to North Korea. So it's likely that that Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, either in the telephone conversation or when they met during the G20 meeting in Japan, that they had some talk about the North Korea issue and about Kim Jong-un and where his would he commit again? Were he still committed? Would he be willing to meet Donald Trump? Because the way it's been presented in the press, it's been that Donald Trump took a huge chance when he tweeted that I'll go to the DMZ. I hope Kim Jong-un will meet me. But maybe he likely had some kind of indications from the Chinese President Xi Jinping that if he presented such an invitation, Kim Jong-un would likely be very positive and meet him.
And the payment was Huawei.
Yeah, I think that's maybe taking it too far. And we have no clear, but of course it's interesting. And Donald Trump before has indicated that there was a possibility of trading off different issues. You know, if he could get the Chinese to cooperate more on North Korea, he might be he might be more willing to work with them on the Taiwan issue and, you know, also Huawei. So if Donald Trump has clearly given strong indication that he has this approach of trading off the different issues. But in this case, I think with the Huawei, we don't have any indications, but there might be in all, and also in agreeing with Xi Jinping that at least for now, they will put the trade war more on hold, not put any further tariffs right now and try to get negotiations going. At least that was maybe part of the whole more positive atmosphere developing, and Xi Jinping's contribution to that could very likely relate to his visit to North Korea.
Only a few years ago, we were living in a global economy with the sky as the only limit. This has changed. Today, several global-oriented companies ask, where will this end? Do you have an answer?
Well, no, I don't know where it will end, and I don't think anybody knows. But I'm concerned. And it's difficult to confidentially point to forces or groups or people who can seriously counter the strong forces that are now pushing for decoupling and for treating China only as a threat and a rival, which will only cause these great power tensions, this rivalry between the US and China to further intensify. So The big concern here is that the hawks, both in the US and in China, they seem to be dominant and they only reinforce each other. So all the other voices and forces working for a different approach or for strengthening international institutions and all the other things that really produce this strong, peaceful, positive time we've had since the end of the Cold War, they have really difficulties coming forward now. It's really difficult to be heard. So hopefully that will change, but I have really difficulties seeing right now how it will change. And in some ways, we've seen this coming for a long time. Of course, you indicated that we had this, we're living in a global economy with only the sky as the limit. But for us working on international relations and geopolitics, we've seen it come for, we know that there are that it's really difficult for a new great power to come into the system without this causing tension and conflict. And it requires a lot of the existing, especially of the existing, the established great powers. And in this time, it's only the US really that was the established great power. So it requires a lot of flexibility, adaptability, And we're not seeing much of that right now. But as we talked about earlier, maybe the EU has a role to play here. But that requires a strong, unified EU. And again, here, there's not too much optimism, but small positive indications in recent months, maybe. But all in all, I'm very concerned. I don't know where it will end. But I think for the next years, we will see growing push for this decoupling. We'll see growing tensions in the international system, and it spreads to all fronts. You could say economy, of course, technology, really international politics, security, but also to more soft issues like cultural exchange, research exchanges, corporations. It also gets mixed into this more confrontational China-US camps thing, which is really concerning, I think.
Camilla Nørup Sørensen, thank you for taking part in this podcast.